No self-respect.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Tuesday, May 19th. We're going to go out of order today. The first item on the agenda is Senate Bill 928. Open a public hearing and ask Representatives Tomei and Senator Devlin, please.
Senate Bill 928A requires employers to make reasonable safety accommodations for victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. It provides a list of reasonable safety accommodations that may be but are not required to be used, as such as unpaid leave. Prohibits an employer from refusing to hire or retaliating against an individual because the individual is a victim, and allows an employer to request documentation. No revenue impact, minimal fiscal necessity.
Okay, thank you. Please, Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and fellow committee members. My name is Carolyn Tomei. I represent House District 41, which is Milwaukee and Southeast Portland. Thank you for allowing me to testify today regarding Senate Bill 928, which provides important protections for employees who are victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. This bill accomplishes two goals. One, it prohibits discrimination against a person because he or she is a victim of domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking. And two, it requires reasonable, again, I stress reasonable, safety accommodations for victims who qualify unless the request would impose an undue hardship on an employer. This bill is important public policy. And while most employers in this state already are acting according to these principles, the unfortunate reality is that sometimes victims are unable to seek the protection they need for fear of being demoted or fired. We know that economic independence is a primary indicator of whether a victim will be able to maintain safety from abuse. And firing a victim because of abuse reduces the chance of future safety for the victim and minor children. And taking steps to make a workplace safer provides security not only for the victim, but also it provides safety and security for other employees and for the workplace as a whole. This bill is a reasonable proposal that balances the interests of employees, the employers, and our communities. Domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking are serious public health and safety issues in Oregon. It is in the public interest to reduce domestic and sexual violence by enabling victims to seek safety and redress the effects of violence without jeopardizing their economic security in their jobs. This bill is workable for employers. They can require an employee to prove that he or she is eligible for relief, and they are exempt from the safety accommodation requirements if they would be unduly burdensome. For this reason, this bill is a priority of the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance, and I thank you for your consideration and your support. And I'd certainly be open to any questions.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I apologize if I will be a little bit redundant. I'm here to testify in support of SB 928A, here with my good friend, Representative Tomei. The bill comes to you from the Senate floor on a 25-3 vote. Senate Bill 928A protects employees who are victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking from discrimination or retaliation in the workplace. The requirements in the bill, although significant, are reasonable. It is simply that an employer would provide reasonable safety accommodations if requested by the employee who is a victim of domestic violence. The bill does not specify what reasonable accommodations are, but it could be as easy as modifying a work schedule, changing a work telephone number, or moving the victim's desk to a different location. As already indicated, if any of these requirements might place an unreasonable burden on the employer or an unreasonable hardship, they would not be required to actually do them. Senate Bill 928 is good public policy. It is a very unfortunate reality of public life today that domestic violence is here, as it has been for decades, and probably is not going to go away anytime soon. This will help protect employees by removing barriers to safety and economic security. It will help employers by reducing absenteeism, health care, and other costs, and it will also help coworkers by reducing the potential of violence in the workplace. I ask for your support of Senate Bill 928A to make sure victims of domestic violence feel safe while they are at work, or at least as reasonably safe as they can.
Any questions for this panel?
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We have several more people signed up, but I'm going to close the hearing. We'll reopen it in a little bit. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 928, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 310.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is Representative Jeff Barker, and we're in a hearing in the House Judiciary Committee in Oregon.
Yes, thanks so much for calling.
Okay, and what we're going to do, I'm going to have some other people testify first, and I want you to hear their testimony. Senator Prozonsky is going to testify, and then Andrea Meyer will be testifying, and then we'll ask you to testify towards the end, if that's okay.
That sounds great. Thanks again.
Thank you. Okay, Senator Prozonsky, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, Floyd Prozonsky, State Senator, District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. I'm here today to give support for a bill that came through our committee on the Senate side, Senate Bill 310, and ask that you give consideration and passage regarding what this bill will do. It basically would require that law enforcement agencies in specific type of cases, aggravated murder, murder, manslaughter 1 and 2, criminal negligent homicide, aggravated vehicular homicide, and sex crimes, to preserve biological evidence in an amount that is sufficient to develop a DNA profile. This bill was brought forward with a significant request for, let's say, being much broader, and also was, let's say, unmanageable when we had it on our side. What we intended to do with this is to preserve the evidence, as I mentioned, in these particular cases over a two-year period. The reason for the two-year period is, to be lack of better terms, a moratorium on destroying or releasing that evidence while we are able, as a legislature, to have a work group during the interim to determine what would be the uniform process and procedure we want to have within this state for retention of this type of evidence in the future. The goal here is basically to, let's say, call a timeout, require this information to be held during this two-year period so we can have a uniform process statewide. That's the nuts and bolts of why I have moved 310 through the Senate process with basically what is, lack of better terms, again, a moratorium that would sunset on January 2nd, 2012. I will tell the committee that I just received today, and just before the hearing, started an opposition that you'll be hearing from the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, which is also supported by the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and the Oregon Association of Property and Evidence Officers. And reviewing the information in the handout that they will be providing to you, I would tell you that some of the concerns they have, I believe, have already been addressed in the bill as to what type of offenses the DNA evidence needs to be required. Their first concern was broad retention of sexual offenses, and they bring up the concern about some of these sexual offenses being misdemeanors. If you notice the list that I read through as to 310, it is limited to felonies. And so we are fine with that because we believe that there is a difference between the two types of offenses and realize that those who are charged with the felony are, in fact, facing much more serious consequences as compared to those with a misdemeanor. Regarding the second provision that they have in there is preserving portions of the physical evidence. The concern here apparently is the property officers are not trained for doing forensic work or qualified to make those decisions. I would submit to the committee they can work with those that are certified smart as forensics taking such as a rug that may have some type of DNA or biological evidence that a DNA profile could be made, they could cut that portion of the carpet out and retain that and not have to keep everything else. We fully appreciate and understand that keeping everything intact as it comes into the property room or storage area, because some of these things could even be such as an automobile, are very big, very broad, and that is why we considerably ratchet back as to what would be required during this period. Again, the goal here is to retain whatever evidence is in possession now over a two-year period until we get this conformed. The last concern they raise is the courts have been exempt as custodians for the purposes of retaining this information. And the reason for that is it has been in my practice that once a case has been adjudicated, unless it is going up on appeal, there's a time where the court clerk will give notice to the district attorney's office as well as to the defense bar that they need to pick up whatever evidence is was entered into evidence by themselves. That means the evidence would be released from the court back to the district attorney's office that prosecuted the case, who I would expect in turn would return it back to the police agency that it came from, and that's where I would expect it to stay and be retained over this two-year period. And again, we're trying to work to maintain some continuity until we can get a uniform process throughout the state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for Senator Prozanski? Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Prozanski, with your background and everything, what are you thinking of, I mean, for the law enforcement agencies for having to expand their evidence lockers?
Mr. Chair and Representative Olson, we believe, or I believe, I should say, under the scenario that we have before you in 310, there will not be a significant need of expansion of their evidence lockers because of the size of quantity that we're looking at. As you know from your days as a state trooper, you may bring in evidence that's, let's say, you could actually have biological evidence on the side of a car from some type of accident. We believe that the biological evidence that's on the car could be captured without retaining the whole car. I know that one of my larger communities, Eugene, had a concern for EPD, whether they were going to have to expand their storage areas, and we took that in consideration. It's not our intent that be done, but instead that capturing just the biological or a portion of the biological information that could be used for establishing a DNA profile, not the whole, item that has that evidence on it.
Okay, just one other question.
Please.
So you had conversation with Eugene PD or Police Department then of their framework?
Chair Barker and Representative Olson, I did not have specific conversations with anyone at the department, but the representative of the lobby component for the City of Eugene did contact us after we had the bill moving forward with a letter of concern and quite possibly was opposition at one point. They probably or may still be there. I'm not sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you. May I be excused?
You may. Thank you very much.
With the shrubs.
Ms. Meyer, please.
Don't let him go that easy.
Out of Dodge here. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, here obviously in support of Senate Bill 310 engrossed, a proposal that we brought forward this session. It is, as Senator Prozanski has mentioned, amended, but it is an important, critical next step in our criminal justice system. And a bit of background, because this issue and the DNA innocence law has been around for a while, and some of you may remember it, but in 2001, we passed what we call a DNA innocence law, allowing for post-conviction testing after someone has exhausted all of their conviction process. If there is DNA biological evidence that has been retained, it might not have been tested because technology changes. Technology might not have existed. The DNA might have been traced. When this was passed, it was supported not just by the ACLU, but OCDLA, the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police of Oregon, the Oregon District Attorneys Association. There was no opposition, and this was an important step that we've permanently now codified in ORS 138.690 to 698. I want to be clear about the type of evidence we're talking about as this connects to that. This is evidence that was obtained in the original investigation. It is not new evidence, and the law in terms of being able to have the evidence tested is very limited in scope. I won't go over to the details, but it requires a motion to the court and an affidavit. But since we brought that legislation forward, that legislation came forward many years ago, I have been asking, and ACLU has been asking the question, what are the practices and policies across the state for retention of biological evidence in cases where there has been a conviction? If we do not have evidence to test, what is the point of having this DNA innocence law? To date, as of right now, there has been no answer to that question. This bill has had a very interesting history. I will simply report that when this bill, as originally introduced, with both a statute explicitly requiring a system in place and a task force, was introduced and heard in Senate Judiciary, the only folks who testified were myself, Ms. Brown from the Innocence Project, and Gail Meyer from OCDLA, who does join in her support today. There was no further illumination on what the practices and policies are across the state with DNA retention, but it is a conversation that is long overdue. As you know, across the country, innocence has been established by those who did not have access to testing of DNA, and sometimes the DNA testing was done improperly at the time, and other times in light of the change of technology it's allowed. And I know Ms. Brown will speak to, I believe it's now 232 exonerated individuals since 1992. The only reason those individuals have been exonerated is there had to have been preservation of evidence along the way. In 2004, Congress passed the Justice for All Act, which is codified in federal law, recognizing the need for preservation for federal offenses. And they now have detailed federal regulations implementing retention policies in the federal government, and over a dozen other states have enacted preservation language. We must join this effort and provide some safeguards, because if a person is incarcerated and is innocent, that means there is a perpetrator out there who's never been brought to justice. Senate Bill 310, as you've heard, is now quite a modest next step as originally proposed, and is a moratorium, a two-year moratorium on the destruction of any biological-based evidence obtained in sex crimes and aggravated murder and murder. I need to, as Senator Brzozinski said, he stands corrected. I needed to correct that it is all sex crimes as defined under the Oregon statute, ORS 181594, and the reason is simple. That mirrors the DNA innocence law. Again, the law that allows someone to have testing, but if there's not evidence. So that's an important link, and that explains why we have that link. This moratorium allows us as Senator Brzozinski said, hold on. If we can't do a statute this session, which apparently we're not able to, then let's have a timeout and freeze. Now, I want to explain what evidence we're talking about. Representative Olson, as you know, this would not be new evidence in an investigation, because in an investigation you may not have actually found the perpetrator yet. It may be a new case that you've collected evidence on and are still trying to find the perpetrator. We know it would be evidence that much of this evidence might not be destroyed anyway, because it's going through the years of post-conviction. What we're talking about is the evidence today where there's been post-conviction and all the process is done. We have no idea what the quantity and quality, but what is even left, because this evidence could have already been destroyed. But what we do know is local jurisdictions must and already have practices, because they have cold cases. They have ongoing cases. They must be preserving that evidence. And this just joins the effort. And this won't be the big automobile, because by the time we're talking about a moratorium on this kind of evidence, they've already put it, the OSP's already probably studied it, it's already been put in a size that's appropriate for preservation. Again, we're not talking about newly found evidence in a new case right now. That's the big car, and the local jurisdictions are, oh my gosh, we have to preserve the whole automobile. That's not the case. And again, as you'll see in their testimony, we do limit the preservation under the moratorium is not absolute. They are not required to preserve if the size and bulk or physical character as to render retention impracticable. But the custodian shall remove and preserve only the portions likely to contain biological evidence in a quantity sufficient to permit future DNA testing. I'm sure the Oregon State Police is quite versed and expert on this. Federal laws and federal regulations already exist to provide clear guidance. I hope this would not be a basis to not hold and preserve this material for the duration while we figure out a good law. It is necessary law to establish clear policies and practices, not just for preservation, but for destruction. The original legislation contemplated a method for destruction. And we know, regardless of what we do, or if we don't do anything, we still have the problem, because evidence rooms are going to continue to increase in volume, whether it's biological evidence or otherwise. And it is actually critically important with budget issues that we provide local jurisdictions clear guidance so they know when they can get rid of something, when they should hold on to something. It should not expand evidence rooms. It should allow a proper handling of the rooms. We urge the committee to move forward on this legislation. I think I've touched on the provisions that you will hear from the opponents to this, that the retention of sexual offenses mirrors the current law. The preservation of physical evidence in terms of bulk is explicitly addressed in the statute, but we hope that won't be a basis. OSP can certainly guide. The courts were exempted because they have an obligation under state law already to retain evidence that they have in their custody during a period of a case that's before them. And they have to be removed because at the conclusion of that, so they cannot destroy, as the lawyers know, you send your case off to appeals to either the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court. They're not about to destroy evidence. They cannot do that. They should not, and they do not do that. But what they do is they hold on, and then they send it back to the local jurisdiction or the attorneys of the involved. So they already have a legal obligation, and they asked to be removed. A number of stakeholders came to me at the very beginning, and we addressed their issues, most of which have now disappeared in the modification of this version. I know Ms. Brown will talk a little bit more, so I want to give her a chance to talk about the bigger picture and how critical this is across the country. But we would hope that we can finally have a conversation and establish good law and policy in Oregon, but at the same time, make sure that that discrete evidence that could be destroyed, we don't even know if it would be right now, is preserved. We urge passage of Senate Bill A. Engrossed. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions before we go to the telephone? Ms. Brown, you're ready to go, please. Go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Rebecca Brown. I'm a policy analyst with the Innocence Project, and on behalf of the Innocence Project, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. The Innocence Project was founded in 1992 at the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law to exonerate the innocent through post-conviction DNA testing. And since its introduction, forensic DNA testing has proven the innocence of 238 people. In fact, since I last testified on this bill, an additional 6 people have been exonerated through DNA testing. Not one of these exonerations would have been possible without the proper retention of biological evidence, nor would the identification of many of the actual perpetrators of those crimes. To date, the real perpetrators have been identified among 103 of the 238 exonerated. As you know, properly or poorly preserved, lost or destroyed evidence can frustrate even the most aggressive efforts to solve cases, whether it be a cold case or one that seeks to exonerate someone who may have been wrongfully convicted. Our nation's evidence rooms have become crime-solving gold mines. Understandably, when legislation is considered like this, evidence custodians become concerned that they will be expected to save evidence for which they believe they have no room. And in 2004, the federal government faced this same concern when they passed the Justice for All Act, which included provisions for mandating evidence preservation for all criminal offenses. This was all federal criminal offenses. And in order to make the law practicable, the feds issued a set of regulations which spoke to the concerns about the retention of large bulk items and provided a set of case examples to help interpret the law, which Ms. Meyer just referenced. For instance, if a crime took place in a vehicle, the entire vehicle didn't have to be preserved, but a cutting could be taken of the probative evidence. Oregon can look to the federal regs for guidance. Indeed, this is a practicable reform, and passage of this bill would not even require the immediate retention of additional evidence. It would only require that evidence already in the state's possession be held onto for safekeeping pending the concluding date of the moratorium. Hopefully, by this point, Oregon will have the opportunity to convene relevant stakeholders and determine best practices regarding evidence retention for Oregon.
practical considerations obviously have to be balanced with the notion of preserving all evidence, but I think we can all agree that the retention of biological evidence that has the power to settle innocence claims and identify the true perpetrators of crime should be a primary law enforcement objective. Unfortunately, in state after state, we've been appalled to learn about evidence loss and destruction. And just to give you a sense of that, between 2004 and 2008, our office was forced to close just under one quarter of our cases from around the country because evidence was destroyed or could not be located. And this simply can't continue. New forms of DNA analysis make it possible to test evidence that was just, even a few years ago, impossible to get probative results from. Mini filer amplification, mitochondrial testing, these are some of the most recent DNA testing advances, and they make it possible to learn more than ever from limited or degraded evidence. A mask or another piece of clothing found at a crime scene contains skin cells that have only recently, in the last 5 years, been subjected to DNA testing with any regularity. And such testing has resulted in the exoneration of wrongfully convicted people. Moreover, it's led investigators to the true perpetrators of crimes through CODIS hits or to potential suspects through non-CODIS exclusion of the convicted and inclusions of other suspects. And I'll just share a really brief case with you that I think really illustrates this beautifully, which is Ricky Johnson. He was convicted in 1983 of aggravated rape. He was sentenced to life without parole in Louisiana. His conviction was secured based upon the strength of conventional serological testing and an eyewitness identification made by the victim. With the case going to trial years before DNA tests were to become common law, were to become a common law enforcement tool, no DNA tests were performed on the evidence. And throughout this ordeal, Mr. Johnson continually maintained his innocence and held out hope that the truth would one day be discovered. In 2006, after our office took on his case, the DA agreed to test swabs from the rape kit using conventional DNA testing, which is called STR testing. And the test produced just three markers, which was enough to potentially exculpate Mr. Johnson, but not a sufficient number to help identify the perpetrator. In 2007, just 1 year after that testing took place, a new form of DNA testing called mini-filer STR testing was performed. Mini-filer STR makes possible the examination of badly degraded evidence. And through the use of this new technology, eight additional markers were found, yielding a full profile. And this led to the identification of the true perpetrator, and it was only made possible by the retention of the evidence attached to this crime. That profile not only proved that Mr. Johnson was innocent, thereby leading to his exoneration, but also enabled the evidence to be run through CODIS, you know, the National DNA Database. And the process resulted in a CODIS hit, and the true perpetrator was housed in the same prison as Mr. Johnson himself. Mr. Johnson's case shows the promise that new technology holds for solving long-forgotten cases, and it's a testament to the crime-solving potential of modern-day DNA technology. The loss and destruction of biological evidence, of course, also harms crime victims. In 2007, a Pulitzer-nominated Denver Post series shed light on the tragic consequences of evidence destruction, and it shared the perspectives not only of the potentially innocent, but also of crime victims. And one story focused on Susan Cash, a woman who was raped in 1985. After a multi-year odyssey in which she searched for the rape kit in her case, she was informed that the evidence had likely been destroyed. She was quoted in the series as saying, "I can't believe this," adding that the kit had been kept for only 3 years after her assault. "You keep taxes longer than that. What I've been told is that they had a storage problem. That is so infuriating. What bothers me is that it can still happen now, today. I've been told over and over that things are done differently, but at the same time, there should be a better system in place," unquote. Safeguarding biological evidence is in the interest of all members of the criminal justice community, from crime victims to law enforcement to the wrongfully convicted. In a large portion of cases in which the innocent are exculpated, the guilty are also identified through CODIS hits. Many states have begun to realize that their retention policies fail to keep up with DNA's technological advances. Just last year, three states passed laws that mandated the preservation of biological evidence. This year, Mississippi passed a comprehensive evidence preservation bill. The bill before you is an incredibly modest bill by comparison. It would only, through a moratorium, protect evidence, save that evidence, and allow for all the relevant stakeholders to come together and approach a solution in a measured, reasoned way. So I thank you for your efforts to improve Oregon's evidence scheme. Please feel free to call upon us at any stage in your work, and we're grateful to you for all that you've done thus far.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Brown, for your testimony. That's very helpful.
Great, and I'm happy to, you know, answer any questions if anyone has any.
Does anybody on the committee have questions for Ms. Brown? There are no questions, so again, thank you very much for your testimony, and we'll I'm sure Ms. Meyer will be in touch with you.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you. Kevin Campbell, John Powell, and Adam Walsh, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I'm here today with a few concerns that are being distributed to you right now. Thankfully, Senator Przanski covered them already, so I won't have to go into a great amount of detail. But I want to begin by saying that, one, Andrea mentioned that we did support the innocence legislation that's already been passed in the state. And our concerns about this bill do not in any way take away from our commitment and our interest in making sure that those who are innocent, who are convicted wrongfully, do have the best opportunity to claim their innocence. And we understand that biological evidence is a very important part of that. We also understand that new technologies and our better ability to analyze DNA data, including mitochondrial DNA analysis and others that were mentioned just a minute ago, are coming online in greater degrees. And so the concerns I'm expressing today are not to be considered in contradiction to this value. I also want to commit not just the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, but the Oregon Property or Association of Property and Evidence Officers. They're a group that isn't really represented in the building. They're a part of the Oregon Police Officers Association. That's an organization that really doesn't involve itself much here. They're kind of a unique combination of labor and management that have come together. They've created an association, and they do good work, but they're not legislatively focused. And part of our challenge in getting around the issues of this bill was actually even identifying that there was an Oregon association like this dealing with property and evidence. That was part of our problem on the Senate, aside from an additional misreading of the bill, in which we believe that the impacts of the bill were solely to be borne by the Oregon State Police. When we found out we were in error, we came into the process, frankly, late and into the discussion late. And I do want to thank Senator Przanski because he did mention that concerns were raised at that point. And Ms. Meyer and the Senate committee did take those concerns into consideration. And so the concerns I'm sharing today, to me, don't represent an objection to what we're trying to get to today. They're concerns that we'd like to raise with the hopes that there's a potential to at least have a discussion and to see if an amendment would be reasonable that it would accomplish this purpose. There's three basic concerns. The first one has to do with the sex offense issue and the broad retention there. I'm a little bit at a disadvantage today because I had one of the president of Oregon Association of Property and Evidence Officers. She could not be here last minute. So the testimony you see, I put together rather hastily, and so hopefully there are no errors in it. But what I heard from them was that the sex offense statutes reference are a large series of statutes that take into consideration the broad range of sex offenses. And the Property Officers Association believes that in many of these cases, this evidence isn't even important. And I think that their concern doesn't come so much from, well, we don't really want to retain that. I think it really is from the amount of the evidence they're retaining at that point. Second point has to do with preserving portions of the physical evidence when the evidence itself is of a nature that it's this large. And that's been mentioned in all the testimony so far. What do you do with this? And I believe, first of all, I'm thankful that they're taking this into consideration. So please know that we're thankful that they're trying to give us a way to reduce the size of the kind of evidence we have to retain when we're trying to identify the biological portions that are relevant. Our concern has to do with that the responsibility for making that decision based on a reading of the bill is the custodian themselves. And the Oregon Association of Property and Evidence Officers were very clear with me that they are not trained in forensics to any degree. They receive the evidence, they are to store the evidence, and they are to maintain the integrity of the chain of custody. That is the handling of the evidence from the very beginning to the very end, and that is their job. They indicated that to do this piece properly, they felt like they needed to be trained in terms of the forensics understanding of what's required here. Now, I heard Senator Przanski mention that he believes that that can be done in concert. with another entity that does have the forensics expertise. And I don't disagree with them in that. In practice, that's exactly what would happen. My concern is in the language of the bill, the custodian is the one that is identified with the responsibility for accomplishing this task. So I guess I would say all of that to say that I believe that it can certainly be, this piece can be fixed. And maybe through clarity, maybe in talking to counsel, we may come to a different conclusion, but at this point we believe the custodian is on the line for making the determination. So if there's an adjustment in language that can be made there, we would appreciate it. Finally, in the definition of what a custodian is, there's a clear line towards the end that makes it clear that a custodian does not include the court. The concern with property and evidence folks is that the court does take the evidence at different times and places within the court or the proceeding of the case. They take it into their custody, so to speak, and then are a part of the chain of custody that represents the integrity of the handling of the evidence. Yeah. And according to our folks, they believe the court should be included in terms of the responsibility, at least for preserving and handling the evidence properly while it's in their possession. They do have specific cases that they listed with me, and I won't name the agencies or the courts where evidence was turned over. It was either disposed of improperly, so we actually lost the evidence, which Ms. Meyer and others who are proponents of the bill, we lost that altogether. Or it was not maintained in a manner that preserved the evidence itself so it could be used subsequently. And so these are concerns in my mind that are not deal breakers. And I will say again that all of the associations listed and the concerns listed here are very willing and committed to sit down to try to formulate in this interim period a law that I believe everybody will be pleased with. And I think it can be done, and according to our folks, that's both their intention and their hope. But I did want to go on record and at least let you know some of these concerns. As it relates to sex offenses, our preference would be to have this limited to felony cases. So I'll put that on the record. And with that, Chair Barker, thanks for all the time to let me go through that. I'll turn it over to Mr. Powell.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, before you, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. The only comment I'd have is following Andrea Meyer and Kevin Campbell. There are no words in the English language left to utter. So I have nothing to add, Mr. Chair.
Is that a compliment?
Backhanded. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Adam Walsh with the City of Eugene. I'd just like to echo Mr. Campbell's concerns over including misdemeanor sex crimes. We'd like to see it restricted just to the felonies.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for this panel?
If you keep talking, I'm voting no sign.
Yeah. Representative Stigler?
So I just been, if the reference under F of
the sex crimes,
if it just said those sex crimes listed in 181.594, which are misdemeanors, that would be, which are felonies,
correct. Yes.
Or felony sex crimes is listed under somehow delineating that.
Yes, Chair Barker, okay. Representative Stigler, that would accomplish the purpose. Thank you.
And in looking at that, it appears an attempt is part of that, which I know that attempts oftentimes reduce a felony down to a misdemeanor. So I would think that kind of broader language would be okay.
Yeah.
Would be sufficient.
Yes.
Okay, and then I had a question about your second. Do you know how many courts, judicial jurisdictions, actually have evidence retention practice and procedures? I mean, do you know how many of them actually have something spelled out, or how many give the evidence back to, you know, the proponent? I mean, do you have any idea what the situation is in that regard?
Chair Barker, Representative Stigler, she's looking at me like I'm asking this question that I know you don't know the answer, and the answer is no. I can tell you that with the police agencies on the city and county level, the policies are a part of our Oregon Accreditation Alliance program, and so we're actually developing those policies that are not only just policies on paper, but in the accreditation process, and we're always growing in the number of agencies that are in it. those agencies not only have to have it on paper, they have to know it throughout the agency. And so I don't know about the courts, though, at this point.
And that, I mean, that potentially could be, I mean, I know that, I don't know if there's a uniform. My sense is, just practicing in the districts that I've been in, that there's not necessarily uniform evidence retention procedure, but
Chair Barker,
it would be nice to know
that. It sounds like this is the kind of issue that needs to be discussed, too, during this period between now and then.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. John and Kevin, the chiefs and the sheriffs have entered into a relationship with a state accreditation, and part of that accreditation involves proper procedures for collecting evidence and retention. And from what I understand of that, that's all same level playing field, and it's real similar to what my old agency was as well. Can you expound on that?
Chair Barker and Representative Olson, last session we passed Senate Bill 351. That was the missing persons bill. It actually was the one that involved the use of mitochondrial DNA through their testing lab in Texas. And just to give you an idea of what happened, that bill was passed, and the Oregon Accreditation Alliance actually put together then a model statute, integrated as a part of their accreditation, but on top of that, made it available to all agencies. So whether you are accredited or not, they're responsible for creating a best practice, and this is the kind of thing that's particularly valuable, as you might guess, to groups like City County Insurance, who are represented or responsible for ensuring these agencies that if they're not performing based on a best practice, represent liability to groups like that, and that's why or how that process has worked.
Mr. Chair, just a side note on this. I like the direction where this bill is going for the evidence, and considering what's going on down the future and everything for the innocence perspective. I do have some concern with what Senator Prezansky, where I was going, where he brought it up himself with the collection of evidence and the retention of a large object versus that of trying to collect some type of a small biological sample. I mean, if we could do something to that degree, given, you know, maybe some timelines with the Senate bill, I think this would be a really good direction to go.
Okay, thank you. And go ahead, Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Campbell, you mentioned that the Oregon Association of Property and Evidence Officers weren't really involved in this until just recently, but I see them identified in the bill, and I was just curious if there's a disconnect there, or
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, are they in the actual bill listed?
Yeah. They are on line 17 of page 3.
Oh,
there is no page 3.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Oh, wow, that's good. I didn't even know.
What are you talking about?
Thank you.
I don't understand.
Representative Shields. That just means Andrea knew more than I did.
The bill already lists, he mentioned that the property evidence people, they didn't know such a thing existed. The bill actually includes them.
Includes them in
their group by name. On page 3, line 17.
I don't have page 3.
I am convinced.
So the question is, I'm not sure how much conversation actually occurred with that organization in the development of the bill.
Okay.
Because I know that I had some discussions with Andrea Meyer during the interim, one meeting. But at that meeting, that group was not present, and I was not aware of any subsequent conversations, and I don't believe that they were aware of any conversations, but maybe Ms. Meyer can clarify whether she had the chance to talk to them or not.
Well, and if I could just make one final comment. I'm always concerned when lobby groups come in at the last minute and express concerns on a bill on one side that they didn't express on the other, and sometimes that's just the way the process works, and I can appreciate that. I would still like to see Senator Prezansky's bill get through this session, if at all possible, and I'm trying to figure out exactly what your position is. Is your position saying that you're willing to work on it now to get it passed, or is it that you're opposed to this bill until the end of the session, and then you're interested in working on something later?
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, I believe that if we could get
a little amendment here and there on this, in particular regarding the sex offenses is the most important of these. I want to make sure that we're not requiring custodians to do something they're not capable of doing. So I just want to look into that more. But if we can make that adjustment, we are committed to work in the interim, and we will be able to support the bill if we can get a few adjustments. So it's not a, we just want to kill something at all costs.
You're committing to passing the bill this session and then being on the task force in the interim. That's what you're saying.
We'd like to minimize any unintended impacts of this that may require the kind of evidence retention that could create problems for space-limited groups. Thanks.
You're committed yes. to passing the bill in
yes.
this session. Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Stigler.
I just, the other issue that if we're not working this today, Mr.
We're not,
Chair.
We're not.
Okay. What I'd like cleared up is because I would have concerns about chain of evidence issues, and I wouldn't want those to pop up as, all due respect, I think the concept here is really good, and I'm where you are, Representative Shields, wanting to move something out, but the last thing I want is there to be some chain of evidence issue that pops up out of as a result of this that then becomes the basis for somebody bringing lawsuit that is really it has everything to do with nothing to do with the substance, but everything to do with the process and the procedure. So, if we're going to do something like this, and I think it can be fairly minor, adjustment of some language, but that would be what I want to protect against because there are a lot of cases that can be come under this within the next 2 years, and that goes partly to the court evidence. Issue and who, how it gets passed off, and making sure that those processes and procedures are, that we're all understanding where those go, or that there's some escape valve in the event something falls apart there. So,
the chain of evidence is vital not only for the innocents but also
yeah.
to find out who did it.
Sure.
And if that's broken, everything's gone. So, what my intention is to do is to give this a breather. Hopefully, we can accommodate any little things. I do plan to move the bill out before we're done this session, though. So I'm sure we can get an accommodation of whatever we need to do there. Anything further? Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 310. And reopen the House, the public hearing on Senate Bill 928. Mel Cone, Sybil Hebb, and Cassandra Skinner-Opata, maybe? Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Sybil Hebb. I'm with the Oregon Law Center here today in support of Senate Bill 928A. Very much appreciate the time that the committee is given to this important issue. I'm testifying today on behalf of the Law Center as well as on behalf of the Oregon Alliance to End Violence Against Women. This is one of our priority issues because, unfortunately, so many of our low-income clients are struggling with issues of domestic violence as it impacts the workplace, and that dynamic is something that we see trapping our clients in a vulnerable situation, further exacerbating their poverty and making it harder for them to move out of that dynamic, and also exacerbating the risks to their safety at the workplace. And so Senate Bill 928 is a reasonable and important proposal that we believe will provide some important public safety aspects to the community and to the workplace as well as to individuals. And for that reason, we are in support. I will briefly summarize the bill and then go into some of the details about some of the aspects. In short, the bill accomplishes two major goals. One is it prohibits discrimination at the workplace on the basis of the fact that a person is a victim of domestic violence or sexual assault or stalking. That's an important public policy statement because, of course, it does not make sense to treat someone differently based on the fact that they have been victimized by illegal acts of another party over whom they have no control. And it's an important statement to make because victims too often fear coming forward and seeking help or disclosing the nature or circumstances of their abuse for fear of discrimination. By clearly making the stance that discrimination is illegal is not okay, that makes it easier for people to come forward and to seek help. So it prohibits discrimination. It also requires reasonable safety accommodations if requested by an employee to help address the domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking. And those safety accommodations could include changing a phone number, for example, or an extension number, or moving a desk, installing a light. It will be a fact-specific analysis as to what makes sense to try to address the safety issue. But those are the two basic principles: to prohibit discrimination and to provide a means by which an employee can request a reasonable safety accommodation. There are just a couple of points I want to stress as we move forward, which is that economic resources for victims of violence are essential to their ability to move forward and out of that violence and to further keep themselves safe as well as their children safe. And so the intersection of domestic and sexual violence and the workplace is a nexus that we're especially concerned about at the Law Center. And we have seen many, many examples of employers stepping forward to do just wonderful things for their employees to try to help them through those circumstances in a way that results in greater safety for that particular individual as well as for the workplace as a whole. So I want to be very clear here that I'm not suggesting that employers are not already doing these two basic things. Most good employers already act as though under the guise of this law. We do unfortunately have some examples of circumstances in which victims who are employees have not been treated appropriately, and it's for that public policy reason that we want to move forward with the bill. We do think that establishing this as a public policy is something that is good for employers. Having the disclosure of violence, if it exists, is something that is good for employers to know so that they can help make their workplace safe for everybody. And so we think that there is a benefit to the community, to individuals, as well as to the employers. I want to speak specifically about two provisions that are addressed in the bill that provide some sidebars, if you will, to the use of the law. The bill prohibits discrimination across the board, but the reason reasonable safety accommodations have some specific prerequisites that must be satisfied before that responsibility is triggered. One is the employer may request that the requesting employee provide certification that he or she is a victim. And the bill spells out the means by which that certification can be provided. It can be by court order or court documentation or by a copy of a police report or by documentation of a third-party professional. And so this is a means by which employers may require that there be some evidence shown to them that the employee is eligible for the relief. In addition, the request for the safety accommodation must be something that's reasonable, and it must be something that's connected to the threat of the domestic or sexual violence. And then on top of that, there is sort of a catch-all sidebar that allows an employer to be exempted from the safety accommodation requirement if the accommodation would be something that would impose an undue hardship on the employer. And the definition of undue hardship is currently specified in Oregon law at 659A.121, and this bill links to that definition, and that definition specifically provides for an analysis of the particular circumstances of the employer. It looks at what are the overall resources, what is the size of the employer, how many employees does the employer have, what's the overall goal, purpose, objective of the employment, and does it make sense for this accommodation to be made given all of those circumstances. And so that's a protection for the basic specific individual circumstances of the employer. And if there is an undue hardship, then that particular aspect of the bill is exempted. And so these are sort of two sidebars that are put into place that we think make the bill not only an important public policy, but also a very reasonable proposal that we think is workable. applicable. Just as a backdrop, this is consistent with the terms of a governor's executive order that was signed and issued in October of 2007 that has applied to all state agencies and that state agencies have been operating under since the beginning of 2008. We think that's working well. This provides consistent policy in the private sector. In addition, there are 22 other states with similar kinds of executive orders on this topic. So Oregon is taking a step that puts it into parity with a number of other states already working on this issue. I would just add in summary that we think that the bill as provided will ensure that it will be easier for victims to come forward to disclose the nature and circumstances of their abuse, making it easier for the workplace to address situations that may threaten the workplace. And so I'll just share one example with you. When I was a legal aid attorney working in the Bend office, I had a client who was an employee of a salon, a day spa, and there were manicurists lined up in front of a window, which was on the street front. There were a second row of manicurists that sort of went back into the depths of the spa, but this person's, my client's abuser, the perpetrator, would go to the Starbucks right across the street, which also had a big glass window, and he would sit there and watch, and her station was right in front of the window, and of course that made it very difficult for her to work and to concentrate. His purpose was merely to intimidate her, and he would wait and see when she took a break or left, and he would then follow her. So the employer in that circumstance was able to move her station so that she was not in front of the window and she was moved to a further back station. This was not a burden on the employer at all. It was an easy thing to do and it did reduce the threat of safety and it also made her a more productive employee because she was able to concentrate on her work and not feel threatened. So we think there are many examples like that that provide just a great benefit for victims, and we think that the bill will be an important step forward for Oregon's public policy, so we appreciate your attention. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Cassandra Skinner-Lapata, and I'm here in support of SB 928A in my three roles, my first role being a small business owner, my second role being a family law attorney in Eugene, and my third role being a survivor of domestic violence and sexual assault and stalking. As a small business owner, SB 928A makes economic sense for both employees and employers. The reasonable accommodations for employees, changing locks, schedule accommodations, even changing places of where that person would work, would be minimal in cost compared to hiring, advertising for a posting, vetting that person's application materials, interviewing, and the time cost with that, and then firing that person and rehiring, going through all that process. This accomplishing the reasonable accommodations for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault and stalking would actually produce a workforce that is safe, appreciative, loyal to that employer, and the source of priceless goodwill and word of mouth for those employers who are willing to do it. As a family law attorney, as we know, economic stability in the form of employment is vital to victim success in getting out of their abusive situation, providing food for their families, seeking housing, seeking legal resources, providing health care and staying safe. And that means employment and ability to obtain work and maintain work. Also, the obtaining and continuing employment means less chance of reliance on state aid in the form of TANF, food stamps, OHP. The loss of jobs from a personal perspective in my practice, the loss of jobs or lack of hiring based on abusers' actions against my clients is very common. I have 8 to 10% of my caseload are affected by these issues. And then on a personal note, as a survivor of domestic violence, it is striking the ability of economic stability to ensure safety and a family's welfare. And that state aid provided me with a fallback for economic issues that I could have dealt with if I had been employable at that time and based on actions that were not my own. So I urge this committee to pass SB 928A, and this makes sense for employers, employees, and victims of DV and sexual assault and stalking. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cohen.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the acting director of the Public Health Division at the Oregon Department of Human Services, and I'm also here to speak in support of this bill. From a public health point of view, violence between intimate partners is a very serious problem. According to a survey that we fielded in 2001 and 2002, almost 25,000 Oregon women experience a physical assault by an intimate partner, and almost 9,000 experience a sexual assault every year. The frequency of this problem dwarfs that of many other serious health risks that Oregon women face. Just by way of comparison, Oregon women experience breast cancer approximately 10 times less often than these kinds of assaults. These victimizations have very serious effects. Physical injuries are frequent and often serious. In our survey, roughly a quarter of the physically assaulted women reported that they were knocked unconscious. 11% had bones broken or joints dislocated, and 6% suffered knife wounds or lacerations. Psychological scars are also very serious. Compared to women who had not experienced this kind of violence, victims were twice as likely to report chronic depression, three times as likely to report anxiety, almost four times as likely to report post-traumatic stress disorder, and twice as likely to have considered suicide in the past year. Given these mental health problems, it's perhaps not surprising that the use of alcohol and other drugs is also more common among women who have experienced this kind of violence. So from where I sit in the public health world, it's simply not right that women should have to choose between their work and ensuring their health and safety. Having to make a choice like that really re-victimizes these women in a way that is only going to exacerbate the injuries that they've already suffered. And this bill will provide women the stability they need at work to allow them to protect themselves where possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions for this panel? Representative Olson.
Is my understanding that this bill only impacts women? Is that what I just heard you say, Doctor?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, I don't believe that's the case.
You said that three times just now.
It says victim. It just says victim.
Well, I know. Okay. But that's what he just said.
Okay.
Just clarifying that.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, members of the committee, the bill is absolutely directed at people who are victims, and whether they be male or female, absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Jane Downing, Mike Wells, and James Titus. I think it's James. Thank you. Just go ahead. In any order, please identify yourself for the record.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Jane Downing. I'm the executive director of Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service, and I have been working with victims and survivors of domestic and sexual violence for 18 years. To date, I've trained over 25,000 individuals around the Northwest on the issues of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. And in the last year, I've trained thousands of employers. There's been a huge rise in the number of employers saying, I want to make a difference for individuals. I have folks in my employ that have either faced this or I've heard about it, and I want to know what to do in order to be as safe as possible for the employees that I'm working with. And one of the most exciting pieces about that is they want the backing of things like Senate Bill 928A to say, I have a basis to be able to say there are some things I can do to make a difference for my employees. And we're not talking about huge things. The employees that I talk to that their employers have taken steps to be able to help them have said it's never really the big things. It's their willingness to be able to want to do this. It's moving their place of employment, as Ms. Hebb had talked about, or putting in an extra light in the parking lot, all those places where they can make a difference on increasing the safety for their employees. And I have talked to so many who have said, I also have had employers that don't do the right thing. They don't help make a difference. They lose their job. They are economically disadvantaged. They don't know what they're going to be able to do to protect their children, to have that employment that they need in order to rebuild their lives free of violence. This bill is an important step, and I encourage you to consider it, and I thank you for your time and consideration. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm Mike Wells from Welch's, Oregon. I have both an employer and a landlord in the area. My wife and I have four businesses in the area, primarily senior housing, so you know we're not working real hard right now. But I also serve Clackamas County on the Economic Development Commission and the Workforce Investment Council, and have served three of the past years as president of Clackamas Women's Services. I've been able to experience the unique chance to be able to provide the help that a victim needed, and had the ability to change the power and control struggle that she was having with her perpetrator. I've had that pleasure on five occasions now, and gives me the desire to have you pass this 928, because SB 928, because there's just still too many employers that don't understand what domestic violence is. And on the gender issue, I'm sorry, I'm a consumer of numbers as a businessman, and of the surveys and the studies I've read, 95% to 97% of the perpetrators are male. 95% of the people in the prisons in the United States are male. So when I'm addressing domestic violence, it's always the victim is female. I really urge you to pass this. It's no cost to business. In fact, I can name you three or four businesses that consider it to be an increase in productivity. It is a great connection to their employees, and it has vastly more positives than it has costs. So thank you for having us here today, and thank you for trying to break the silence on domestic violence. It's a tough issue, and sorry you have to listen to so many negative numbers.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm James Titus. I'm president of and owner of Titus Financial in Portland, Oregon. I was asked to speak to you today as a small business owner. I also am on the board of directors of the Raphael House of Portland, which is a shelter for domestic violence survivors. We just had our first male resident go through the program just last summer, interestingly enough. So we've had to rewrite all of our language in our bylaws. We're currently doing that right now to reflect the fact that we're talking about survivors in general, not just women. When I was asked to speak, my first concern was what the cost would be to a small business owner, and that it could be, I'd hope not burdensome on the employer. After reviewing the bill at length, I am quite satisfied that with the provisions in place protect both the employer as well as the victim. I am clearly an advocate for victims' rights, and I am satisfied as a very small business owner that it would not put undue burden on the businesses. So thank you for your attention to this matter, and I appreciate being here today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Bob Esterbrook.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Bob Esterbrook from the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. You have written testimony from the Bureau, and I won't reiterate all of the great arguments that have been made already. I'm just here to express bully support and the support of our Commissioner, Brad Avakian, for Senate Bill 928, very reasonable protection for some folks who really ought to have that sort of protection, and also to point out the logical extension of this protection from provisions created last session that require employers to provide leave to victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking in order to get the services that they need in order to continue with their lives. This seems like a logical next step, and we're very happy to be here in support. I'd be happy to take questions.
Okay. Anybody have any questions? Mr. Esterbrook, thank you very much. close the public hearing on Senate Bill 928 and open a work session on Senate Bill 928.
Representative Bill 928 to the fourth, due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrett moves Senate Bill 928 to the fourth, due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Martin?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Excused.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carried. Would we like to carry that bill?
I'll take it.
Okay. Representative Stiegler will carry the bill. Okay, and this is the one that Bruce is here for. Okay, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 839. Senator Starr, please. Go ahead.
Ready? Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 839 adds a victim of human trafficking to individuals eligible to participate in the Address Confidentiality Program of the Department of Justice. It defines a victim of human trafficking, provides rulemaking authority to the Attorney General with special reference to severe forms of trafficking under 22 U.S.C. 7102. There's no revenue impact and there's a minimal fiscal impact with no statement issued.
Senator Starr.
Hey, thank you very much. For the record, I'm Bruce Starr. I'm the state senator from Western Washington County. I have the great privilege of representing the great citizens in Hillsborough and Forest Grove and Cornelius and North Plains. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify this afternoon on Senate Bill 839. This is a extremely simple bill and yet I think a very important one. What this bill does is as your council has informed you, it adds victims of human trafficking to the Address Confidentiality Program. It's very simple. But you think about human trafficking in general, you don't think about Oregon. You don't think about, maybe you don't even think about the United States. If you think about human trafficking, you most likely you think about Indonesia or far-flung places around the world where this is maybe a more pronounced problem. As you might be aware, there was a task force on human trafficking that worked in the interim and presented the findings of their task force on December 11th of last year. And based on those findings and that task force, it demonstrated the fact that there is human trafficking really here in Oregon and in the United States. What they found is that the trafficked individuals basically fell into two categories. You either had immigrants that were brought into the United States illegally and trafficked, or you had the second group are primarily teenage runaways who are compelled into the sex trade. Either case, when you have a situation where you have one of these victims that is identified and rescued, there's a very, very important need to separate that individual from their trafficker and provide that wall of separation or provide that opportunity for the victim to escape or get away from the person that is trafficking them. This bill, in a very small measure, does that or helps to do that. And very simple, there's a couple of nonprofits that we're working with that have ask us to introduce this. One of them is Compassion First out of Beaverton. They're focused primarily on the trafficking issue internationally. And you also have Transitions Global, which I presented to you some testimony from James Pond. Locally, James is actually a constituent of mine in Hillsborough. They have Transitions Global, where they have actually had a facility donated where these victims can can take these victims, rescue them, rehabilitate them, provide the services necessary to basically move these individuals back into society in a restored fashion. So with that, Mr. Chair, again, it's very simple. It's a small step forward. I can provide copies of the of the task force report that outlines additional things that the Department of Justice ultimately has been handed. Just an FYI, we did talk to the Department of Justice as it relates to this particular bill. They believe they can do it within their existing budget, within the existing program. That's why you don't have a fiscal impact, really, on the bill. With that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer questions. With me is John Calhoun, who would like to provide testimony as well, and there's a few other folks that would like to testify.
Okay, I don't have a sign-up sheet with me. Go ahead, please, Mr. Calhoun.
Yes, my name is John Calhoun, and I am testifying on behalf of the Oregon Center for Christian Values. OCCV is a nonprofit uniting Christians across the religious pews and political aisles. We seek God's justice for the poor, the oppressed, the sick, and our environment. Most of us growing up in the United States assume that slavery ended with the Civil War and the passage of the 13th Amendment. Nevertheless, slavery still exists. Today there are 27 million people worldwide, hundreds of thousands in the United States, and many here in Oregon that live in involuntary servitude. They work in sweatshops, in homes and restaurants, on farms, and in brothels. They include immigrants and U.S. citizens, adults, and children. According to the CIA, an estimated 14,000 to 17,000 foreign nationals are trafficked annually into the United States. The number of U.S. citizens trafficked within the country is higher. An estimated 200,000 American children are at high risk for trafficking in the sex industry each year. And unfortunately, trafficking numbers are increasing in Oregon. In response to increased awareness of this problem, there is a new abolitionist movement underway. In the 19th century, Christian activists in the U.S. and Britain led the charge against slavery. OCCV follows in this Christian tradition. While the issue in front of the committee today is not as consequential as the passage of the 13th Amendment, it is a necessary step forward. Under the Federal Trafficking Victims Protection Act of 2000, any child under the age of 18 being sexually exploited is a victim of human trafficking and is entitled to appropriate services. We need to implement that requirement. In Portland, during the summer months, the city's police find 3 to 5 cases each week of girls under the age of 18 who are victims of forced prostitution. So this is according to Keith Bickford, a Multnomah Sheriff's deputy. Soon after police pick up one of these victims, they are back under the control of their oppressor. This also means that not only the victimization continues, but the traffickers escape justice as there are no witnesses able to testify against them. The solution in these situations is to break the bonds between the enslaver and the girls. In many cases, this can only happen where the location of the victim is protected. That is why you need to pass Senate Bill 839. Once the victim can no longer be contacted by the traffickers, they can begin the healing process, and the police have a chance of prosecuting the predators. Oregon does not yet have secure housing for victims of human trafficking, so address confidentiality is the next best option we can offer. Well, one could argue that the current law provides that victims of trafficking are currently eligible for the address confidentiality program. It is important that this implication be made explicit. It will remove any doubt about who is covered and also make a statement that the citizens of Oregon are going to help the victims of trafficking. We all know that this by itself will not end trafficking in Oregon, let alone the world. However, it will help some abused children and assist our police to get predators off the street. It is a first step. It is our hope to work with you on a more comprehensive package of laws in the next legislative session. I'm not here as an expert on trafficking. There are others who can tell you much more. I'm here today to say that we as a community need to do what we can to protect our children and those who are most vulnerable. If children enslaved in the sex trade are not oppressed, I don't know who is. We need to take steps to release them. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate that. Any questions for this panel? Representative Krieger.
Senator, are you aware of any prosecutions in the last 2 or 3 years regarding trafficking?
No, not.
Okay.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question perhaps for you, Senator. I don't know if you got my message. I left a message into your office. I very much appreciate your bringing this bill forward. I support the bill. I recognize the problem. I support the intent of it. And indeed, I even like the way we've done it. My only real perhaps a question, I suppose, is with the delegation of authority to make rules to the Attorney General. And there are actually two of them, and I note with some interest that actually the delegations are different. The one on the first page on line 24 in particular essentially is without any bound whatsoever. And I'm wondering why do you think that's necessary? Is it possible? Do you think the bill would be better if we narrowed it just a bit?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Bartner, if you what you see in lines 21 through 24 basically is restoring language that's deleted in lines 31 through through line 2 on the second page, where currently the Attorney General has rulemaking authority as it relates to victims of sexual offense. Where we've added the new victim of human trafficking, we just basically replicated that existing rulemaking authority, but referenced specifically the definition of human trafficking as it relates in the, as it's outlined in the United States Code.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to call Kathleen Maloney Dunn and Siobhan Sheridan Ayala. Ayala, something. Please go ahead and identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Maloney Dunn, and I'm a human rights and international criminal lawyer. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 839. Existing Oregon law fails to adequately protect or promote the recovery of victims of human trafficking. This bill, SB 839, is an indispensable first step towards remedying the situation. First, it is important to place this bill in proper perspective. This bill is about victims' rights, the rights of victims of organized crime. Let us not forget human trafficking is increasingly perpetrated by organized, sophisticated criminal enterprises. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services reports that trafficking in persons is the second largest criminal industry in the world. Human trafficking is a transnational crime with national, state, and local implications. I ask you to carefully consider this question. Who deserves or needs more protection than a victim of organized crime? Surely such victims merit at least as much protection as our state already grants to victims of domestic violence, a sexual offense, or stalking. The victims of these other crimes seek safe harbor from an individual usually. The victims of human trafficking seek safe harbor from individuals as well as organized networks of criminals. Oregon's legislature has the opportunity to start providing a crucial piece of this protection by passing SB 839. This bill will help reduce the cycle of victimization, the chain of bondage with the aggressor, the cycle of continuing crime and servitude in our state. So ultimately, this bill is about public safety. But this bill is also about personal safety and the right of trafficked victims to finally elude their assailants and oppressors. This measure therefore symbolizes hope. SB 839 is the first strand in a web of safety we as a society are morally obligated to weave for our most vulnerable citizens. These crime victims, by virtue of being treated as modern-day slaves, have suffered the loss of their freedom and human dignity to abusive and profiteering traffickers. Their humanity has been stripped away. Today, we have the chance to restore a portion of their stolen humanity. In Oregon, there is an urgent need for secure shelters where such crime victims can receive the services they need to recover. The work group of the Oregon Task Force on Human Trafficking recommended in the report of December 11, 2008, to the Senate and House Interim Judiciary Committees the provision of secure housing for victims of human trafficking. The task force found the following. Quote, those involved in trafficking of persons do so by controlling the basic necessities of life of their victims. Safe and secure housing is not only a way of protecting victims, but cutting the link between abuser and abused. They thus recommended a pilot project in Portland for teenage runaway girls consisting of secure living arrangements similar to a domestic violence shelter. According to the task force, runaways are prime candidates for human trafficking in the sex trade. And secure living arrangements would reduce not only the likelihood that these girls would be involved in crime, but that they would become pregnant. Currently, Oregon does not have any secure shelters for human trafficking victims. It does not even have a shelter for victims of severe forms of human trafficking under federal law, such as child victims of sex trafficking, which Senate Bill 839 recognizes as individuals the Attorney General may designate as eligible for address confidentiality. The nonprofit Transitions Global stands ready to build and run a secure shelter in the Portland area for victims of such severe forms of trafficking, girls who have been sex trafficked, as soon as adequate funding is available. Someday, hopefully soon, we will witness this shelter and other secure shelters following its lead, launching victims into new lives of relative freedom. Freedom from crime, freedom from their traffickers, freedom from terror. The bare minimum we can do for these victims in the meantime is to pass this bill giving them legal access to address confidentiality. It may not seem like much to anyone who has not lived in fear or in servitude, but those who have and those who have worked with these victims understand that peace of mind is priceless. It is also essential to true freedom. Let us not only provide safe haven in shelters in Oregon, let us provide these victims of human trafficking safe haven at home and in society. Today you have the opportunity to give new meaning to the term safe house by providing these crime victims something as important as short-term shelters, a long-term safe home at a confidential address. Adding victims of human trafficking to individuals eligible to participate in the address confidentiality program of the Department of Justice may have a minimum fiscal impact, but its human rights impact in the state of Oregon will be tremendous. Please cast your vote in favor of human rights for trafficking victims. Vote for Senate Bill 839. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. My name is Siobhan Sheridan Ayala, and Representative Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. I practice immigration law full-time, and I've worked with immigrant human trafficking victims for the last 6 years, 4 years at Catholic Charities Immigration Legal Services, and then for the last 2 years with in private practice. And I wholeheartedly support Senate Bill 839. I was part of the drafting group and the working group to implement Oregon's anti-human trafficking law, and I think that this is a very important piece for making Oregon's laws more comprehensive in terms of assisting human trafficking victims and sending a message that trafficking is not tolerated here in Oregon. Let me just tell you a little bit about why this is important. If you can imagine yourself for a moment in a foreign country where you don't speak the language, say Japan, and you're being held by your employer and they will not let you leave, they have your visa, your passport, and they're forcing you to work. You are fortunate enough after maybe a year to find a way to escape the situation. Someone offers you help, but in your mind, you've been so terrorized for that year, you are so afraid of your trafficker, you're afraid to leave because you know they will find you. They know where your family lives here in the United States. They know a lot of places they belong to organized crime, so they have lots of resources to find you. That's why this bill is important. It allows people to leave a very oppressive situation. That's the first reason. The second reason is I think that this bill impacts victims and prosecution at two important points. One is escaping the situation, and the second is increasing the ability of victims to participate in prosecutions. When someone is a victim and they're working with law enforcement, they're putting their lives on the line. They are exposing themselves. They're confronting the traffickers in the courtroom. It's a very risky situation, and traffickers who are put behind bars make lots of threats to the victims and continue to harass, and it's a very intimidating process. So passing this bill where that person can live in the United States in a confidential place will also help with prosecutions. That's just what I wanted to say, and I support the bill, and thank you very much for considering this. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Beth Creighton, Chair Barker and members of the Judiciary Committee. I came up here at the request of the Senator to address Representative Krieger's question, which was whether or not there were prosecutions of human trafficking claims in Oregon. I currently represent employees in an employment-related dispute and a human trafficking civil claim under the statute that was passed in 2007. and I've had a close association with Keith Bickford on this case, who has informed me that he's currently investigating and participating in the prosecution of approximately 15 cases in Multnomah County. His position is solely to investigate and prosecute human trafficking claims. That's all he does. So there, that is happening in Oregon.
Amazing. Any questions for this panel? I'd like to thank you very much for your testimony. It's unfortunate that so much of the public sees prostitution as a victimless crime. They've watched movies like Pretty Woman, which has nothing to do with real life. Those of us who spent careers in law enforcement, there's some on this panel, know the difference. And thank you very much for your efforts.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 839. Open a work session on Senate Bill 839.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move Senate Bill 839 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves Senate Bill 839 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Stevens.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries.
Would somebody like to carry it? Representative Shields, thank you very much. Thank you.
I was a sponsor.
I am.
No.
Okay.
You are too.
Over the public hearing on Senate Bill 794. A.
That was a stomping bill.
Senate Bill 794A changes the way attorney fees are awarded in condemnation proceedings, requires the government to pay attorney's fees and costs if the judgment exceeds the highest offer instead of the initial offer, ensures the property owner will receive attorney's fees and costs incurred on or before the offer of compromise if the owner accepts the offer of compromise or the owner rejects the offer and does not achieve a better result. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact. You have a summary of Dash 3 amendments is currently on your staff measure summary. Those are essentially the Dash 4s that are being passed out, minus a typo that I believe will be addressed by the proponents.
Okay.
These are in place of the Dash 4s, or 3s?
Yes.
Okay.
Martha Pellegrino, Harry Arbach, and Dave Honeycutt, please.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martha Pellegrino, representing the City of Portland. With me today is also Harry Auerbach, who is a Chief Deputy City Attorney with the city. I've just submitted a letter in support of the bill from City Commissioner Nick Fish, who wishes he could be here today but had a conflict, and sends his appreciation to this committee for hearing this bill. Before I proceed in the details, I just would like to briefly recognize one of my co-panelists and someone else who's worked very, very hard on developing this version of the bill. In the Senate, when Senator Prezanski asked the city to sit down with Oregonians in Action and see if we could develop a consensus bill, I'll admit that my first reaction was not one, was not hopeful. Having said that, working with Mr. Honeycutt, he has came to the table and brought some very good ideas about how to make this a better bill and how to reach consensus on it, and has invested a fair amount of time and effort into making sure that we have we've gotten it right. So just wanted to make that acknowledgement, and also wanted to just say a thank you and acknowledgement to Linda Ludwig with the League of Cities, who also has lent her expertise in this area of law to this bill and has helped create a bill that has broad-based support. Senate Bill 794A addresses the narrow issue of how attorney's fees are paid in condemnation cases. For many years in this state, the law allowed a government to make a written offer to the property owner as late as 30 days before trial without the risk of paying property owners' costs and attorney's fees unless the court awarded an amount higher than that offer. The law essentially placed the risk of going forward to trial disproportionately on the property owner and gave an unfair advantage to the government by allowing the government to lowball the owner up to a month before trial. As you'll recall, ballot measure 39, which passed by Oregon voters in 2006, prohibited a public entity from condemning private property if the intent was to convey the property to a private developer. However, the measure also altered the attorney's fees portion of the statute, requiring that a public entity pay the property owner's costs and fees if a court's award at trial exceeds the public entity's initial offer. So the bar for triggering responsibility for attorney's fees went from 30 days before trial to the government's initial offer. In practice, this provision has resulted in the unintended consequence that a property owner always has the incentive to take a condemnation case to trial. And because it is likely that the court will award somewhere between the government's initial offer and the property owner's demand, it means that a public entity will frequently offer considerably more than the fair market value in order to limit its exposure to attorney's fees, which means fewer resources are available for needed programs and services. In order to address this problem, Senate Bill 794A makes two changes to current law. First, it changes the attorney fees trigger from the government's initial written offer to the highest written offer prior to the filing of a lawsuit. This provision gives both sides an incentive to negotiate and settle without initiating a legal proceeding. For those cases that do not settle before the filing of an action, the bill also allows a public entity to make an offer of compromise up to 10 days before trial. Whether the property owner decides to accept or reject this offer, under this bill, they will be entitled to recover costs and fees up to the date of that offer. If the property owner rejects the offer and the court's award is more favorable, then the property owner is entitled to all of their costs and fees through the end of trial. Senate Bill 794A is a compromise between what the law is today and what the law was prior to Measure 39. The bill gives property owners and public entities equal incentive to avoid litigation and pursue fair and expeditious settlement. I urge this committee support of the bill, and with the chair's permission, I'd like to turn things over to Mr. Hauerbach and Mr. Honeycutt to offer additional comments and address the Dash 4 amendments.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Harry Hauerbach. I am a chief deputy city attorney for the city of Portland, and in that capacity, part of my job is to manage our litigation section, which includes the lawyers who are responsible for bringing condemnation actions on those occasions when the city finds it necessary to acquire private property for public purpose. We came to the legislature with this bill committed to a product that is fair both to the government and the citizens it serves and to private property owners whose property we find it necessary to acquire from time to time. That's been our lodestar from the beginning is fairness to both sides in an eminent domain dispute. And so I have found that I also want to echo Martha's recognition of Mr. Honeycutt on my right here. He's been working diligently with us to come up with a bill that preserves that balance of fairness to both sides, and I appreciate the perspective that he's brought to this bill. So when we were in the Senate, the bill passed out of the Senate with an understanding that there was an additional amendment that David wanted that we were going to ask be made in this body, and it's because of the time we have to work with to get bills processed through the body. So here we are asking you to finish the work that we started on the other side. And that's represented in the Dash 4 amendments. And basically what we want to do is provide for the situation in which an offer of compromise is made that includes a discrete component that represents the just compensation for the property and damages to the remainder, and a discrete amount for the costs and fees. So the bill before you allows an offer of compromise to be made in one of two ways. We can say to the owner, here's what the property is worth and the damages to your remainder, and we'll let the court assess the fees and costs and expenses that you've reasonably incurred as of the date we've made this offer, and we'll pay that. In that situation, it's real easy to tell whether a property owner who rejects that offer obtains a better result or not. You go to trial, he gets a verdict either from the court or the jury that says, here's the money the government owes you. If that's more than what we offered, obviously, the property owner has got a better result. When, however, you have an offer that has a discrete amount for the damage portion and a discrete amount for the cost and fees portion, it's a little more difficult to tell whether the property owner has beat that offer if he hasn't accepted it. And so we've provided in the dash four as a mechanism to provide for that. And that basically says, well, the court will determine what was the reasonable amount of costs and fees that the property owner had incurred as of the date of the offer that was not accepted. What did the property owner get for damages and compensation at the end of the process? Add those two numbers together, and if that's more than the amount that was offered, the damages and the costs and fees that were offered in the offer of compromise, then the property owner's got a better result and recovers all reasonable costs and fees incurred throughout the course of the litigation. So that's the purpose of the dash fours. We have a consensus between us and David's organization that this is an appropriate amendment. Be happy to answer any questions. Oh, the only other thing I want to make sure that I don't forget to say is that we're not asking through this bill to do anything that's unusual in civil litigation. All we're really trying to do is incorporate a version of what's already in existence generally in civil cases through the rules of civil procedure for offers of compromise into the specific context of eminent domain litigation. So it's a process that already exists in other contexts. We're just trying to make it to tailor something that's applicable to this special kind of proceeding. So I will stop there unless the committee has any questions. And David had one more issue that I know that he wanted to bring up.
Hey, Mr. Honeycutt,
we also
please.
Have agreement on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of this bill with the dash four amendments. I've spent a lot of time here in the Marble Nut House over the years. I don't think I've ever had a bill where we reached consensus quickly and then spent hours upon hours drafting the language to get to the consensus, but I think we finally got it right with the A4 amendments. This is a complicated, this was a complicated drafting process for a bill that essentially is designed to give the city or the condemning body a second bite at the apple. They can make their initial offer. Subsequent to that, they can make another offer if over the course of the proceedings and just prior to trial, they determine that their original offer was too low. They can make a subsequent offer. At that point, the property owner has a limited amount of time to accept or reject that offer, but. If they accept that offer, they will be entitled to all of the fees and costs and expenses that they've incurred prior to the time that the offer was made. So the property owner, our concern was making sure that the property owner was made whole throughout the entire course of the proceedings. That's the case here. The only exception to that is if the property owner rejects an offer, goes to trial, and gets a judgment that's less than the offer that the condemning body made 10 days or more prior to trial. In that case, the property owner is on the hook for the attorney's fees and costs that they've incurred post-offer. They still get the attorney's fees and costs and expenses that they've incurred prior to the offer. Those post-offer, they're on the hook for. So that's an incentive upon our part to try and negotiate in good faith. We like 39 as it is. The problem with 39 from the property owner's perspective, and I appreciate the condemning body's concerns, and those are certainly legitimate. The problem from the property owner's concern standpoint with Measure 39 is that the only way we can get attorney's fees under 39 is to go all the way through trial. So, yes, it does create the incentive for us to take cases all the way through trial, even though we may not, obviously, at least in my experience, representing individual citizens, most people don't want to go to trial. So that was a problem with the language of 39. We fixed it here. It benefits the governing body. It benefits the property owners. The one thing that I would like to make clear under this, with these amendments, this bill will determine, will give the court the obligation in certain circumstances to determine whether or not the property owner is entitled to attorney's fees, both at cost and expenses, both pre-offer and post-offer. But aside from that, once the trial court determines, or the jury, like actually it's going to be the court, once the court determines whether fees are entitled pre- and post-offer, the amount of the fees will be determined in the normal course. We're not trying to change the method for determining attorney's fees as they are in any other civil case. This bill doesn't try and change that. It simply makes clear what the court is to consider to determine whether or not attorney's fees are going to be awarded both pre-offer and post-offer in the case of a property owner rejecting an offer of compromise by the governing body and taking the case to trial. So with that, with the A4s, I think it's a good piece of policy for both property owners and for the condemning body, and makes positive change to the law, and we would very much support it.
Okay, thank you, and I really appreciate another does too when people work to come up with a good compromise bill that'll work. So, is there any questions for this panel? Representative Lisnett.
I'm sorry, real quick, I've got to ask Mr. Honeycutt. I know he's a teddy bear. Why do you think the city of Portland had this, you know, unjustified reputation of you, Mr. Honeycutt?
I have, Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, I have no idea. I've always been so kind and generous in my dealings here at the legislature.
As was your father when he was a prosecutor in Columbia County in my young police days.
You're dating yourself.
Good job.
Thank you very much.
Good job.
Amy Joyce.
I'm sorry, Linda Ludwig.
Good luck. Please go ahead.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. The hour is late, so I'll be brief. I handed in some written testimony. I just want to hit three key points. The written testimony references the Dash A3s, which now have been replaced by the Dash A4s, and I think the 4 is correct. One of the problems we had, or the problem we had with the A3s, it does allow us to offer in an offer of compromise a specific amount for the property in a condemnation, and then just say and a reasonable amount for attorney fees and costs to be determined by the judge. And so that corrects that problem. Second point is, you still, under this bill, a property owner would still need to meet the initial threshold of beating the last written offer before filing of the condemnation suit. Typically in a rising real estate market, that's not a problem, but as recent events would show, that could certainly happen. But so you still have to meet that initial criteria. And the third point, the reference to governments lowballing property owners, I would just make the point that ODOT is statutorily required to make an offer which is the total fair market value of the property. In most cases, we hire an independent appraiser. They tell us and give us a written document what the fair market value of that property is, and that's the exact amount we offer. And then negotiations go from there. So I would say the concern about lowballing isn't actual. That's my testimony. I'll take any questions.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Ludwig?
Thank you very much. Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. The hour is late. The League loves the Dash 4 amendments. Okay. Would say good bill should pass and ask the committee to do so. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any questions for you? Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 794A. Open a work session on 794 and I'd look for the adoption of the Dash 4s. Representative Wisnant.
I move the Dash 4s into Senate Bill 794.
Representative Wisnant moves the Dash 4s into Senate Bill 794. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move Senate Bill 794 is amended to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Okay. We don't have the fiscal statement on the dashboard, so we'll have to carry it over. So I'll close the work session and carry it to Friday. And, you don't have to leave. Okay. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 784.
Eight seventy-four.
3 o'clock dyslexic.
We were just checking. Yeah.
874, okay. The Oregon version of the Americans with Disability Act provides criteria for determining whether an individual has a physical and or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more of the individual's major life activities and provides examples of major life activities. As to the list of activities and functions are considered major life activities, no revenue or fiscal impact.
Okay. Bob, go ahead. And then.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Astorbrook, Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. We're here in strong support of Senate Bill 874A. I've had an opportunity to speak with most of you and talk about basically what the bill does. You've got a good summary of it. I'm just going to hit a couple of key points. And a copy of our testimony is coming around. I think that the really key point here, what we have heard from a few individuals, although we haven't heard that there's any actual opposition to this bill, is some concern that conforming with the new federal standard in the Americans with Disabilities Act Amendments Act might create some kind of burden on small employers who are only covered by Oregon disability law and not by the federal law. One of the things that's coming around is a chart which identifies where all of the major life activities that are listed in the bill come from. As you'll see from that, in point of fact, the overwhelming majority of those things are already explicitly in Oregon state law or in administrative rules from the Bureau. What Senate Bill 874A does really is to put those all in one place where employers will be able to look at the statute itself and recognize what sort of major life activities, if they are limited, recognizes the person as having a disability. So from our point of view, that actually makes it easier rather than harder for employers to comply with the law because they will be able to read the statute for themselves and know what it is that they're expected to comply with. This compliance that I'm talking about is, of course, very important. What we seek to do here is to reduce the confusion that some employers may have about what the expectations are for them. And certainly what we think is important here, the compliance with the federal law, it eases our enforcement burden, but also, as I said, reduces the confusion that employers may see if there were a different Oregon standard versus the federal standard. So with that, I would be happy to take any questions that folks may have.
Any questions for Mr. Astorbrook? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Starting at the very bottom of page one and then going into page two where it describes all the things to be considered for life activities, is that new?
Chair Representative Olson, it is not. Most of those, or I should say, some of those already exist in state law. Some of those exist in federal law even before the amendments. A number of those exist in BOLI administrative rules as a result of case law that has developed. As I say, this chart that has come around identifies where each of those major life activities come from. Although the list looks imposing, those are, in fact, already things that employers are responsible for complying with under existing statute and rule.
Just follow up, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm struggling with some of these that are identified in here. How does an employer plug in the concept of thinking as an ADA issue?
As far as whether the individual is, I'm sorry, Representative Olson, you mean as far as whether the individual is substantially limited? Mr. Chair, if I could, Marshall Miller from the Bureau of Labor and Industries, our legal policy advisor, I think might be able to respond to the legal component of that question.
I don't mean to hurt anybody up. We would have set this over, but so many people signed up. We are carrying it, but we are right now talk to you in the end of the
Mr. Chair, please. Maybe if I could just simplify this. There's just a couple of issues out of that that maybe you could address for me. I'm interested, too, in socializing, reaching, and thinking, those three concepts right there, how that applies.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson. Well, as you know, the test to establish disability under the ADA and the Oregon Disability Law as well are whether or not the individual has a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities. So the list we're talking about here have been identified as major life activities, and specifically you've mentioned thinking. So in terms of, you're talking about how would the employer be responsible for these things, they're actually part of the entire test. So if you think of these as activities that most people can do without difficulty, if you, thinking is obviously a brain capacity life activity, and so if an individual is substantially limited in that area, the Oregon rule, as we've gone along with particularly with federal court cases, because the directive in Oregon law was to be consistent with federal law, Oregon, Boley has adopted into Oregon rules these concepts as they've been adopted by federal court cases. So without getting into the specifics of these federal cases, which frankly I'm not familiar with the facts of, federal courts found in specific cases that thinking was a major life activity of which most humans can do without substantial difficulty. So, and similarly, I would say that socializing, in current Oregon law, this is already when it's an Oregon statute, it says socialization, not socializing. When it was put into this bill, it became socializing because they were, I believe, the drafters were looking for ing words. Socializing may sound trivial. Actually, what we're talking about is the ability of humans to interact with other humans. So it was really socialization as it is in the current Oregon law and was adopted into Oregon rule. These are federal cases that specifically recognize that as a major life activity. And reaching has always been identified with the original federal ADA in the interpretive guidance. It's not in the statute or the rules, but the interpretive guidance to the ADA specifically talks about reaching as major life activity, and it's been in the Oregon rules since the Oregon statute was amended to conform with the ADA. So that's what I can tell you about those three specific major life activities.
Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Easterbrook, just to clarify, I don't know if you covered this completely. Isn't it true you have a graph here, and there are only four things on this graph of whatever, 15 or 16, that are new. Everything else is currently codified in other administrative law or some other way. We already have to comply with these other, I guess that would be 11 or so listed life functions, correct?
That is true.
Okay, so the only thing we're really dealing with here in the list that are additions would be major bodily functions, concentrating, bending, and walking.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
I'd just like to thank Mr. Easterbrook for responding to my question about that in page 5, lines 3 and 4, it does specifically provide that employees are not required to accommodate an individual's disabilities. Doing so would impose an undue hardship on the business. So, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Or Krieger. Sleeping. I wake every night at 1 o'clock and I lay there. Am I disabled then? Night after night after night.
An individual who is substantially limited, who has a physical or mental impairment that creates substantial limitation in that area would potentially be disabled under Oregon or
and I think 15P, I would question everyone on this committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, Lord.
Bill Lynch, Megan Cahy, and Beth Crichton.
I do have to get to.
We are late in the day. We're losing members, so.
Yes, I appreciate that. Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Bill Lynch. I'm here in the capacity today as chair of the Oregon Disabilities Commission. And our numbers have diminished over the last couple of hours as advocates in support of this bill. But I want you to know that also in the interest of time, I'm submitting testimony from the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities, for which I'm the executive director, and from the Developmental Disabilities Coalition, and our council is a member of that coalition. So I should have handed these out along with the testimony that I'm going to deliver, and I will summarize.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. This bill was identified by the Oregon Disabilities Commission as one of our top priorities, the reason for that is simple. The original Americans with Disabilities Act is a major piece of disability rights legislation, the major piece. Over the years, it was substantially diminished through court rulings. There was then an effort nationwide. Advocates worked hard to get the ADA, at that time called the ADA Restoration Act, introduced and eventually passed to restore some of the erosion of the bill over the years. And Oregon advocates were very involved in that effort. And now we would like to see those restored provisions of the act and the clarification of intention of that original act reflected in Oregon statute. So that's why we're here today, and that's why the commission, as well as the Developmental Disabilities Council and the Developmental Disabilities Coalition, all are in support of this. Also, you had written testimony submitted by the Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities. So again, our numbers are stronger than they appear here. And I won't read the testimony, but there are several points in here that are important to us, and I think making the intention of Oregon law clear and less confusing for interpretation and implementation by putting the federal changes in the state statute, I think, are very important. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Megan Cahay. I'm Vice President of Mental Health America of Oregon. I'm grateful for this opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 874. I myself have a psychiatric disability, and I come from an advocacy group that represents many persons that have psychiatric disabilities and also other disabilities as well, co-occurring disabilities. And I would like to address how Senate Bill 874 specifically would affect persons with psychiatric disabilities. First of all, the ADAAA, the American Disabilities Act, the present law prohibits discrimination against persons who are regarded as disabled. And I myself, being a disabled person, although I don't usually think of myself in those terms, I certainly know that I have in my life experienced discrimination more times than I care to think about. I know what it's like. Now, some people use the word stigma. I don't care for that word because I think it's a problematic word. It tends to go back into the word stigmata and have all these complicated words. So I prefer the word discrimination. I know what it's like to be discriminated against, and I'm really glad that there is a law that prohibits discrimination towards me and my peers. I think that's a great thing, and I think that is part of our human rights. and our civil rights to have that act and that law. So this bill would affect people like myself in several specific ways. For one point, it says that if impairment is episodic or remission, it shall be considered a disability if it would substantially limit a major life activity when active. So what this means for someone like me is, you know, I'm running around the Capitol doing lobbying work and being active, and I'm functioning quite well. I do have some up times and some rather down times. I am more in recovery in my life now than I've ever been. But my illness, or whatever we want to call it, is episodic. And there are times when I do much better than other times. And I have to admit that. And it used to be that I would go in and out of the hospital with great frequency. Now, I'm hoping that's behind me now, but I'm not positive of that. And my illness is episodic. Some people don't like the word illness, but I still use that. So I could say I'm in remission, or whatever term I want to use. But what I'm trying to say is, there are times that I do better, and there are times that I have to take a few days off from work because I'm not doing as well, even though I have a full-time job. So that is the nature of the situation in my life with my disability. And I'm speaking frankly, and it's a little hard to even say this and admit this, but I'm saying it to you so that you'll understand what we're talking about with the psychiatric disability. Okay, the next thing was the determination of...
Mary, if you could just real summarize, so, because we're going to lose other members, and I think you're doing a great job. I appreciate your testimony. But
okay, I'll just say that the determination of whether an impairment substantially limits a major life activity has to do with whether a person takes a medication or has an ameliorative improvement to their life. So if a person takes medication, they still, and it helps them, they still have a disability. And I take medication, I still have a disability. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you very much for advocating.
Beth? Vice Chairs, my name is Beth Creighton. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'm here in support of the bill. I'll make this as brief as possible. The ADA was put into effect to put people who can work to work and to accommodate those people who are in situations where they can work with limited accommodations. And this is what this bill is about, and this is what we're trying to rectify. The amendments to the ADA were put into effect to remedy the mutation of the law that has happened over the years from the court system, and to help put employees back to work. In my view, as a person that represents individuals and employment claims, this is not a huge change to the Oregon law. The Oregon law has always been a little bit more favorable to those with disabilities than the federal law. And the Ninth Circuit, of course, has not been as mutated as other areas of the country. But, you know, we're not talking about huge substantial changes here, and I think it's a good bill, and I think it should pass, and I think it clarifies the law for all employers to know what is covered, what's a disability, what's not a disability, and what their obligations are under the law.
Thank you very much, Beth. Thank you all for testifying. We have one more. Kathy, yes? Cool.
Okay. Very briefly, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Wild. I'm legal director of Disability Rights Oregon, formerly the Oregon Advocacy Center. And you have already in your handouts a summary of the Senate bill fact sheet that talks about the key changes to the ADA, and I'll leave that for you to read. I won't go through that. Disability Rights Oregon supports this bill because it'll keep the same level of consistency between federal and state laws as we presently have to protect citizens from discrimination based on their disability. We had a former law in Oregon even before the ADA was passed. We reconciled that when the ADA was passed, with the one exception that we kept the smaller employers included, the six, because Oregon's always viewed that as very important. This is a small employer state, and that is now being carried over as we're reconciling the new bill. So it'll align the statutes. The key changes are outlined. There's five or six of them in the fact sheet. And finally, I wanted to address Representative Olson's question about thinking, socializing, reaching. First of all, as you know, you have to have a physical or mental impairment. On thinking, I think the one that probably is most comes to mind is traumatic brain injury, which alters a person's ability to think. They may need more structure. They may need written instructions. They can still perform the essential functions of the job, but they need to have things laid out, and they need some kind of guidance in terms of what they're supposed to be doing. Thinking is a major life impairment, but it can be reasonably accommodated by the employer, and that's what the ADA requires, so that if it doesn't cost too much or interfere with their ability to do the job, you can give them instructions in writing, you can help them understand what their job is and allow them to do it. Similarly, reaching, that's one of the physical injuries in terms of bone injuries or carpal tunnel or other kinds of physical impairments that frequently happen with repetitive motion. That is an impairment. It can be easily accommodated. The person can be moved to a different job. Parts of their job can be transferred, and that's why it is one of the major life activities. So I'm happy to answer any questions. We fully support this bill. Other states have gone further. We would love to see Oregon do that, but at the very least, we'd like to see you reconcile the two statutes.
Thank you very much, Kathy, for your testimony. I apologize for the rush through, but it's important. We're not. This is an important bill, and I'm sure that it'll go through the system. We're going to close the public hearing, and we'll carry this forward to Friday, May the 22nd, for a work session. So the public hearing is closed.
Thanks. You got to adjourn.